Hello and welcome to Gaming Quest episode 431. I'm your host, Mike Epps, aka Wheels, and with me as always.
Fully turn based, David Inferni, Fanboy Master.
Slightly delayed, waiting for the active time battle bar to fill up. Your man in Japan, Michael Baker, Gaiji Monogatari.
Nice.
And Wheels appears to be playing some flavor of Monster Hunter, a very old looking one.
Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate.
Okay, so it was originally a 3DS game, that makes
yes.
sense.
Yes. It's basically Monster Hunter All-Stars.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was called Double Cross in Japan.
It was.
Oh, that one. Okay. Yeah. I recognize the name now.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking Gaijin will have more context for this, which is Japanese name.
That's back in
I mean, granted, I never actually played any of the games in the series anyway, but I do remember the
Yeah,
Double
but
Cross.
You would have seen them floating around.
Yeah.
I made lots of stupid jokes about, hey, when are they going to come out with Monster Hunter XXX?
No, that's
I'm a mature adult.
Well, I would say that's what Comic-Con is for. But
it's got to be for something.
Listen, if there's anything it's good for, it's that.
I do remember the story of the one amateur circle figurine that was banned from Comic-Con. That ended up appearing as a special guest character on one of the Queen's Blade video games.
Oh, of course so. It did. Why not?
Yeah.
Okay. We got a lot to cover and relatively little time, so... Gaijin, tell us what you've been up to.
Oh, unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to mention this 2 weeks ago because I was late on arrival that time. But yeah, I had to give up Romancing Saga 3.
Oh.
Yeah. Just, I remember having the impression from 25 years ago when I was emulating like half of the obscure games from the Super Famicom generation that I didn't enjoy it as much as the others. For one reason or another, and I don't think I could actually put that into proper words at the time, because I was kind of afraid of some of the other people on the major emulation boards on GameFAQs at the time.
That's probably fair.
Yeah, and I didn't really have the right words to describe the issues, but yeah, Romancing Saga 3 just isn't as good as number 2 in many ways.
It has its charms, but 2 is the better game.
Yeah, on a technical level, yes, it's a better game on the technical level. It's one of those where I have to say it still doesn't surpass the previous game in the series. Mm-hmm. Obviously, everything's better than the original Romancing Saga, but at least that one has a decent remake that fixes everything. Romancing Saga 3 does not have that yet. I look forward to seeing if they actually do
a
remake.
I'm sure.
It
might take another 10 years, but I'm sure it'll happen.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that just was really standing out to me on this replay was on double replay, because I actually used the New Game Plus option to reset and start with a different character after a few hours. First of all, there is no real differentiation between characters past startup, and the introduction sequence has very little variation between them to begin with. Like, at least Romancing Saga had everyone starting at different corners of the map. This game, Romancing Saga 3 does not even bother with that. And in fact, 5 out of 8 characters all start at the same inn, with a 6th character arriving from another character's location to that inn, and that's the start of the game. Mm. And then there is very little clue as to where you're supposed to go after the intro sequence, even less so than normal for a saga game.
I know this is not the series that handholds you or tells you exactly where to go after each thing, but throw a guy a clue, please. We've rescued the princess in exile from the dream demon and that had her, and we're trying to need to track down who gave her the poison that let this happen to begin with. And we have a clue, but we have no clue as to how to pursue this clue. As it turns out, you need to recruit the prematurely aged and retired pirate from a different town in order to confront the guy. But there's no clue that you need this character. And then in order to recruit this character, you need a specific item. However, you can only do this if you get the item the proper way, which means you need to start a quest line from a completely different town by talking to the bartender in the town like 5 times in a row. Mm-hmm. When most bartenders don't give you any information in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also perfectly possible to go to this location or go to this dungeon and get this specific item without triggering the quest and then not being able to recruit the pirate after this.
Oof.
It's like, now, even for Saga, this is obtuse. There was one character I recruited on the second time around that I was only able to get because I knew I had looked it up and realized that, oh yeah, I actually have to lose a battle to the bandits in this one area in order to get taken to their base and meet this guy. Except in order to get to lose a fight against these bandits, I had to waste 5 turns in a row to get banged up enough to lose the battle. Even early on. It's like, yeah.
Okay. R.I.P. Romantic Saga 3.
It looks nice, but there's nothing to differentiate most of the regions of the game from one another. There have to be at least as many quest lines involved, but finding any of them without accidentally invalidating them is an issue. Yeah. I'm sorry, I just had to give it up.
Mm-hmm.
I had to say. But yeah, no. Instead, I picked up a new review game, which would be fun. Yeah, Wiseman's World. AKA the game that, out of everyone on RP Gamer staff, I was the only person who knew this game existed before it got announced for remake. Because it appeared twice in Japan Demonium in like 2009.
Jeez.
Yeah. It's looking pretty good for a remastered DS game, I'll say that. I've been laughing at some of the minor issues with the quality of localization, but I've played worse, much worse, in recent memory, last week. fun thing. There is a monster in Romancing Saga 3 called the Taper in the translation. That is not how you're supposed to be translating it. Because in Japanese and Chinese, tapers have been named after a mythological dream demon.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of a cryptid from the middle period of China that was described as kind of round in body, black and white with a funny face.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 19th century, this English scholar in Chinese studies took a look at this description and decided it absolutely had to be referring to the Malaysian taper.
Hmm.
Which, to its credit, is kind of rounded in body, black and white, and has a funny face. Except that China historically never had contact with the areas of Southeast Asia where it's native. So it was more likely a reference to pandas.
Oh. I was wondering if that was the inspiration for Drowsy and Hypno, but maybe
it is. In fact, the inspiration for Drowsy, Hypno, Mushana, and Muna.
Oh, cool! All right.
And the reason why tapers are associated with dreams and eating dreams in many other video games I can think of, the monster in Romancing Saga 3 called Baku is very obviously not taper shaped.
Good night, PJ.
I mean, you could say that it has a long nose, sure,
But otherwise, it's like neon purple and green.
That's like real life.
Yep.
Yep.
It's still called the Taper, even though it's definitely not supposed to be the animal Taper. It is the dream demon that happens to share a name with Taper. In the same way that the Chinese unicorn is also the Japanese name for giraffe.
Mm-hmm.
So if you saw a kidding in a video game and it was named giraffe, you would think that there's something wrong here. That's about the level of oopsie we're talking about with the localization on this monster. Oh, well. Okay. So, yeah, that's why I've been holding in for the past 2 weeks since we didn't have Q&A quests last week. Okay.
Okay, so before we move on to more of what we've been playing, I'm going to quickly hit some of these questions that are sitting in the chat. Is there any equivalent in the video game industry to Marie Kondo being messy and then saying that it brings joy to her? I have not watched enough Marie Kondo because I thought she was the opposite of that. But either way, the anime industry has one, letting Yoko Taro write the script for a new Ava show, something that his games both taken many inspirations from and tried to rebuke at the same time. I'm not sure he's ever actually really functioned as a rebuke. He was trying. I don't think he succeeded. But
I mean, Evangelion itself was supposed to be kind of a rebuke to a lot of the tropes in mecha anime.
He's not even really good at that. Like,
yeah.
Fucking, but I don't even really think that's what it's trying to be.
Yeah.
Like, because Gainax is fundamentally mostly, like, especially at the time, was mostly otaku imitating their favorites, and it has a ton of stuff that's just, this is just an homage to an old thing. The big difference is that the robots are eldritch horrors.
I've seen it referred to as, like, it's definitely an homage to everything that they loved about mecha anime, but also kind of making fun of it.
Or, I don't think it is. I really don't think it is.
Or taking it to an extreme.
I don't even think it's really doing that either.
Probably.
Like, I don't think Ava is actually, like, I think there are significantly darker shows from earlier. Like, I don't think Ava is even anywhere near as, like, grotesque as, say, Zambot 3.
True.
But, which is a show that has a ton of children being forcibly turned into suicide bombs.
90s.
Yeah, like...
I would say, though, that if I had to pick a currently active game or anime writer to take on a project that will necessitate knowing something about Gnosticism to an unhealthy degree, he would be on the list. So,
yeah, but I wouldn't trust Yoko Taro to fucking write a grocery list, so, you know.
I mean, I'm not sure if I would trust anybody to actually write a sequel series to Evangelion to begin with, so... And honestly,
yeah,
I don't
like
care
this
that
is,
much about
this is
theory,
my distaste
so
for both.
This is a fun train wreck to watch other people go crazy about.
Yeah, this is my distaste for both author and property melding together into a horrible thing. I find Ava boring and I find Yoko Taro boring, so. Let's see. But yeah, like, I think that there are definitely situations where we've seen, like, weird developer selections for new versions of things. I can't think of ones that... I'm having trouble thinking of ones that turned out well, but we've definitely seen it happen. And like, sometimes it works out. Bionic Commando being remade by a bunch of... Like, the 2D Bionic Commando Rearmed being remade by a group of Swedish people worked out pretty well. But...
I don't even remember
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Bionic Commando Rearmed for Xbox 360 and PS3 was made by a company called Grin.
Cool.
I think Mercury Stream working on Metroid scared a lot of people, and that worked out well.
Yeah, that's true. So the other thing is, are you going to talk about the new news about the next .hack and the next Soccer Awards? I haven't seen anything about the Soccer Awards thing, but I will briefly bring up .hack because I'm obsessed with it categorically. CyberConnect 2 made an announcement of a new .hack game that looks like it's kind of a reimagining, but we'll see. We haven't seen anything that they were willing to label gameplay. So it seems like we kind of just got a concept trailer. But it showed what looks like the protagonist of .hack being running into some of the things you see in the first episode of the first .hack series. So very plausible that that's a reimagining. The way that they phrased it was very funny because they had to pretend like it was Bandai Namco being magnanimous to let them take on the publishing duties, which is basically Bandai Namco saying, like, you get to take on all of the risk and we get to, like, skim something off the top. But, you know, it is what it is. Okay. And then one more thing that I'm sure only I'll be insanely mecha-brained enough to care about. So Mamoru Oshii is going to work on a new VOTOMS, while the next Pat Labor show will be handled by someone else, talking about resurrecting old properties with new people and new visions. Yeah, I mean, it's useful to have fresh eyes look at things. Like, usually when we see things revived, there's, like, this desire to have the original people behind it do that, but, like, there's worth in letting a fresh set of eyes look at something.
I just wanted to say real quick, I liked three of the four rebuild of Evangelion movies. I just didn't like the third one. I don't know why, but the second one was just amazing. So
I thought they were all garbage claptrap. Okay.
What's an Evangelion?
I have nothing but disdain for Hideaki Anno.
I've never seen any Evangelion.
Yeah,
honestly, the only one I've seen was End of Evangelion because it was being played in anime club thing in college, and that made no sense at all. It was not really meant to make sense at all.
No, I mean,
it makes enough sense. It makes mostly thematic sense, but it's also again an homage to a bazillion old, like mecha anime movies like Space Warrior Baldios or the Ideon Be Invoked, that are just like, here's an alternate ending to the series where everyone fucking dies. And then there's like a bunch of spiritual mysticism. Like, that is basically the Ideon Be Invoked is doing the exact same thing in 1976. But yeah, like, I'm going to briefly... I'll briefly stump for the fact that letting new sets of eyes reinterpret old things is interesting. Sometimes, like, it's important to let properties be reconsidered. Like, you know, if we can't have the public domain anymore, we should at least have, like, corporate stewards allowing interesting new people to take on things. Okay, I'm putting a timer on the clock and I'm giving myself 3 minutes to do a quick rundown on having finished Clair Obscur.
And then I need a Metroid minute.
Yeah, I'll give you a Metroid minute. Okay. Starting in 3, 2, 1. Okay, so I finished it. I think that the story is really weirdly paced and kind of bad. The developers were not clear on how to, like, there's no pacing here. Like, all of the story developments are at act breaks. Everything in between, it's like there could be as much or as little as they chose to put in there. The game's not doing much with that time. The end of second act twist kind of railroads the premise, and the actual ending kind of doesn't care about everything it spent, like, the player was theoretically supposed to spend the first 20 hours caring about. So the ending is thematically kind of incoherent. And it makes an aesthetic choice during one of the ending scenes that is so, like, you're trying to incorporate the number 33 in a way that just makes this look fucking absurd. I will just say that you see a memorial to someone, and if you're reading it, it shows that that memorial says that they died on December 33rd.
December 33rd.
December 33rd.
January 2nd.
There's absolutely, like, I get caring about this. I think it would have, if you needed to incorporate the number 33, You should have just said they died at 33. You didn't need to make the fake number. I spent a while trying to figure out if it was the French Republic calendar. It wasn't.
The French Republic calendar wouldn't have gone up to 33.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I spent a while making sure that it wasn't, like, some obscure, like, French reference, and no, it's just them trying to incorporate 33 in a really ham-handed way. But yeah, like, ultimately, it's not a terrible game, but I think that, like, if someone... Like, I will never be on board with the idea that it's a particularly well-written game, like, whether from a, like, broad plot themes or like an individual character writing perspective. Two of the like five party members essentially have, actually I would say three of the five party members essentially have no development to speak of. They're never allowed anything, even in the ending, like an ending that they should care a lot about, because you're like, you are given a choice about how the game should end, and they should care a lot about what that choice is, and they don't even get to talk. It's like, and with a party that small, that's insane. So yeah, okay, there's my time up. But yeah, the note I'll leave on is that I essentially haven't thought about the game since finishing it, and I think that basically sums up my feelings. It's fine, but it's unremarkable. Okay. We will hit a couple more questions, and then we will hit what either Joe or Wheels has been playing, depending upon who is feeling the most impassioned.
I'm only going to be a minute, and it will be impassioned, okay. But it will only be a minute.
Okay, I'll give you that impassioned minute when we answer a few more. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Okay, people think the next Soccer Wars will be announced in a few days. We'll cover it if it's if it actually is announced before next podcast. Last year, I brought up the idea that fighting game discourse revolved too much around pro players' opinions and why it was bad for game development. But the more I get into that, the more I feel like it's the semi-casual players who are dominating the conversation. Game studios talk a lot about appealing to new players, as expected. Pro players whose voices I've heard are not just understanding about it, but advocating for the measures being taken. In general, pro players want people to play against. Pro players like playing the game. Casual Hopefully. And what's that?
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, theoretically, in a healthy environment, pro players like playing the game. Semi-casual players like winning the game. And that ultimately produces this issue is, if you're not having fun even when you're losing, fighting games are going to be rough. But yeah, the most closed-minded people are in fact those who spent like 20 hours in the game, then 40 hours on Reddit and Twitter listening to others complaining about the game. I can guarantee that 9 out of 10 times you hear someone saying shit like SF6 doesn't reward taking risk or Tekken isn't honest anymore. That person's only spent a tiny amount of time playing multiplayer and isn't even good at it. Yeah, I mean, like, especially because, like, you know, you look at these and it's like, old fighting games were significantly meaner and more insane. People have gone nuts around, like people have gone nuts around tier lists because they're more accessible and you can get, like, they allow you to, like, launder your opinion. But ultimately, like, tier lists are weirder now because in most modern fighting games, like, bottom tier no longer means unusable. Whereas if you go back to the, like, quote-unquote golden age, where you're looking at, like, Street Fighter 2 or Street Fighter 3 or Marvel versus Capcom or Capcom versus SNK, the bottom tier are functionally unusable in any serious context. Like, if you are playing as 12, you are making your life miserable every time that a Chun-Li catches you once and cracks open half of your life bar because she just controls the flow of the fight and can do a ton of damage. If you are playing as like let's even take a less mainstream Street Fighter. Street Fighter 3 Second Impact, if you are playing as Hugo, you're just living with the fact that half the cast has infinites that only work on you.
Wow. Like,
You could, like, fighting games just used to be like that. Whereas if there is a whiff of any kind of practical infinite, it will be annihilated from space immediately. Like, old school Tekken is nuts. Like, new school Tekken tends to have a more devil may care attitude towards balance than a lot of modern fighting games, but it's still, on average, trended towards balance. It has trended away from, here's a complete nonsense thing that you just can't really deal with. They can't play to or play around the system mechanics, so they think that the game is bad. It's like there's hundreds of thousands of dark side fills. There kind of is. The problem of poorly researched essays has existed on social media for years, but with the advent of AI, it's gotten worse. Fighting game YouTubers are all complaining about videos made by people barely understanding what they're talking about, instead just letting ChatGPT skim Wikipedia and read it. Yeah, no, that's a problem in the essay space, especially because, like, there is a cognitive shorthand that I think all of us have at some point, where it's like, if we kind of know the subject but don't know it that well, if someone can pontificate about it for a long enough time, then the assumption is that there is expertise there. I mean, that's the only reason anyone's ever listened to me. And like, AI is really good at spending a long time to ultimately say nothing. So
Loviation.
Yeah, loviation is a good word for that.
Yep. And for everyone to remember about ChatGPT, remember that it takes most of its information from the widest available sources, and that means Reddit.
Yeah.
Oh, the thing, vomit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing that happens with basically everyone dealing with AI is that they'll look at some, they'll see it talk about their own field and note the obvious flaws, like, oh yeah, that's nonsense, that's stupid. And then, like, over and over, you'll see someone be like, but it probably works for this other thing that I don't understand.
And no, it does not.
And it doesn't. We all just need to accept it's bad at everything. Like,
it's like somebody did a study about like AI's use in the thing that it's supposed to be good at, with collating data and finding patterns. Mm-hmm. And found it had a 75% success rate with accounting, which is enough to land you in prison for 10 years.
That's not good.
And that was the best success rate it had with anything being tested. Best accuracy.
Like, we have an existing video game currently being sold that has chatbot based NPCs, and all the quests break constantly.
That was supposed to be one of the possible use cases that might actually work with procedurally generated.
No, it doesn't have a concept. It doesn't have a concept of truth. It's never going to, like, it's just going to put out words. Okay. One more before we do the Metroidvania minute, and then. Okay. Remember someone saying years ago that some Japanese otaku wants to be seen as focal, to look and to feel like they're intellectuals, and the trivia they learned from magazines and forums amount to something. Does this something to do with how, unlike the normal fans who only absorb, otakus try to arrange, categorize, and curate the information they hold? It's wild to see that attitude everywhere nowadays. People doing the faux intellectual thing don't even try to stop and think for a moment. Yeah, I mean, like, as is true of most things, if something is hard, people want to be recognized for it, but not to actually do it. It's why everyone wants to be an artist, and tons of people don't want to actually learn. It's why
I was going to say everybody wants to have written a novel.
Yeah, everyone wants to have written a novel. No one wants to write them, except for fine people like our dear indie author here.
Thank you.
Please check out Princesses of the Pizza Parlor by Michael Yeti.
Among other things.
Among other things, I just wanted to get a quick plug in before we get to the late one, so they can't skip
Thank you.
There's a very good quote. I fucking said this because it's a classic one, but this old one is This is attributed to Mark Twain, so who God only knows if he actually said it. But a classic is something everyone wants to have read and nobody wants to read. Which is how we get like these, like the desire for a remake of any given old game that was popular. Like, oh, I want to have played that, but I don't actually want to play it. So here's the remake. Now you can say you did. And it's just like, well, you played something else, but yeah, you know, like stuff like that. Like people want the prestige of having done something, but don't want to deal with it. And you know, I think ultimately we end up with the need for people to accept that like the prestige of having done something is not actually of worth. Like that's your like brain in desperate search for peer approval, and you need to find better ways to get it. Okay. So that gives us time. Wheels, I am putting 60 seconds on the clock.
You know what? He just left.
Well, okay then.
All right, give me the clock.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, start.
Okay, so I've been playing Agalos. That's really good. But what I want to talk about is motherfucking Silksong and how it infuriates the shit out of me. I'm going to preface this by saying the game is very good. It's very pretty. It's a very good, mostly well-designed game with particular things that infuriate the shit out of me. Hard bosses that you have to replay and learn and try, that's fine. That's cool. This game has a fucking tool system, and all these tools have different sorts of ammo that require that you have to go and constantly refill and grind for all the fucking time, because the bosses are designed to be replayed a bunch of times because they're really hard. So what the fuck is the point in making me run around and get all this stupid fucking ammo to just make this whole process a million times more tedious? This game would be so much better if that whole system was not in the game and you can just we rest and the tools refill. Boom, done. Why? Who thought this was a good
you're done.
Fucking idea?
You had your minute.
Ooh.
Okay, well, okay. Anyway. So, yeah, Dave, looking it up, apparently Mark Twain really did make that quote.
Okay, that's important.
And it was delivered at a speech to the 19th Century Club in New York in 1900.
Nice, but yeah,
however, a very
useful one.
Off somebody else. So,
what's that?
So, he claims to have been quoting a professor of English literature at Wesleyan in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's a very useful quote for human behavior.
Yeah. But yes, unlike many Mark Twain quotes on the internet, this one apparently is actually
he at least said it, even if he was not necessarily its originator.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're gonna hit this latest question, and then we'll give you some time, Joe, to get yours out of the way.
Okay.
I've been thinking about alchemy and Atelier and the alchemist's job in Final Fantasy. These games aren't computer CRPGs, so you can't expect a lot of environmental interactions using items. So the items you craft are used primarily in combat or the economy, if the game cares about it. But like, what game's combat opens up a lot of opportunities for you to use items in a creative way. Atelier bosses are much less resistant to status effects, which is a start. I think the ones that I would think of immediately off the top of my head would be some of Larian's games. I recall, like, this is a simple interaction, but it's worth something when, like in Baldur's Gate 3, where I was like rescuing someone from a trap where it's like, oh no, fire is going towards them. And it's just like, throw a flask of water. It puts out the fire. Then you don't have a timer anymore. Like that kind of thing. You know, obviously that was not really feasible for any of the games we're talking about, especially at the time. But, you know, like that kind of thing allows you to do creative things with items. That absolute fucking nonsense accessory in Final Fantasy XII that just makes it so that anything you use... any status restorative item has the opposite effect. allows for some interesting uses of that, like being able to actually use status effects with a great deal of consistency.
Status effects are something that are prioritized by a lot of games, unfortunately. I mean, against enemies, against you all the time.
Yeah, they're really more of a type of impediment. But I think that's what we run into is that, like, in a traditional turn-based structure, if we don't care about the environment, so we can't use items as traps, mm-hmm. and we don't care, like, the only thing we can do is impede, like, we can cause damage, we can impede the ability to do damage, or we can restore damage. Items end up having to be one of those three things, and it very much limits what you can do with them. You kind of need an extra layer of interactivity to make items have a unique purpose. It can be hard to find them. I think one of my favorite stupid examples of an item having a weird off-kilter purpose is still using a tent in combat in Final Fantasy IX, which had a random chance of whatever you use the tent on being, quote, bitten by a snake and being hit with all manner of weird status effects.
That's better than just using a phoenix down to one-hit kill undead.
Yeah, yeah. No, that one's just very funny. Okay, some real quick ones. Okay, you know, Remake Integrate on the Switch 2 is weird. Instead of just porting Remake from the PS4 to the PS5, SE took Remake's assets, enhanced it to integrate on the PS5, and then put that on Switch 2, I suppose, or Square Enix 1 to avoid the Capcom sequel problem and keep things simple. In the back of my mind, I've got the snagging feeling that I'd rather have PS4 assets on the Switch 2 for a smoother handheld experience. It's a pretty stable 30. I don't know that, like, there was any real hope of getting it to 60, but beyond that, like, one of the issues you run into when you, like, go do a backport of that would be, I mean, they're not going to not include the Integrate content, and that doesn't have a PS4 assets version. That doesn't exist.
No.
There's all sorts of, like, issues that can come from, like, partially rolling back to an earlier version and not all the way doing it. Naoki Hamaguchi has actually been remarkably candid about what's going on with every individual thing. Like, they did the most notable thing that they obviously retained from the PS4 version is that the hair rendering tech is clearly the PS4 version's hair rendering tech. Most of the other graphical effects are PS5 assets. And that one's really interesting because he actually, like, he's been remarkably candid about, like, the technical aspect of this, because he was just talking about, like, well, we used a technique called temporal anti-aliasing, and, like, the way that our hair works is that, like, in order to work with temporal anti-aliasing, it's, like, possible for pixels to essentially be turned on and off per frame. And, like, the result on that was kind of, but, like, the Switch 2 gets much better results from DLSS, which is, like, a hardware, like, cheaper technique for it. So, but it doesn't work perfectly with their hair tech, and they're still working on seeing if they can find some way around that in future, but... You know, it's interesting if you look at the interviews that Naoki Hamaguchi has been granting, he's much more open about, like, trying to explain high level, this is why technical decisions were made. Like, he has some interesting statements about, like, getting like the way that they're designing the game in order to make sure that, like, because people were saying, like, oh, if they're gonna put Remake Part 3 on Switch 2, then they're gonna have to, like, downgrade it for other systems. And he's, like, going into, like, no, we design, it's easier to scale them down than up, so we design, like, high-end stuff that will only really show up for users on PC, and then we downscale them to fit like PS5 is mid-range and like Switch and Series S and Steam Deck are low end, like Steam Deck is the hardest thing we have to optimize for, and like he's just sort of going into all of this in like a very understandable fashion if you don't already know programming, but he's being very approachable. It's very clear that his initial discipline was programming.
That's cool.
So yeah, if you want some, like, I've seen a few of these interviews on Automaton, and they've just had like snippets where he just sort of gives a very high level understanding of like, this is what's going on with the tech and this is why these decisions were made. It's that I recommend seeking those out. He's been really interesting. Allied Purchase Intermission is a separate package, again, though I don't know how many people are like me. I think that would be an extraordinarily hard sell, and it would piss people off real bad if they sold Final Fantasy VII Remake without intermission only on Switch 2. Honestly, they might have actually had problems with Nintendo if they did that. A lot of the console manufacturers often demand some degree of reasonable feature parity. So, like, you need a good excuse not to. To continue the conversation about the WonderSwan last time, the FF4 WonderSwan remake was kind of remarkable. FF4 was an early SNES game. WonderSwan did manage to do everything, mode 7, whatever, on a platform that wasn't that impossible, that wasn't that impressive for the time the game came out, and looks nicer in some places. I mean, the WonderSwan is fairly impressive for what it is. Like, its underlying tech is kind of interesting because it's using, like...
it's got a really awful battery pack.
Yeah, it's got a bad battery pack, it's got a bad screen, but, like, the underlying tech is honestly not bad. Like, it's using, like, the CPU's an NEC V30MZ, which is, the NEC V30 is a... 16-bit offshoot of an Intel 8086. Old, but also like very different from most things for the time.
It was one of those things that they probably tried a little too hard and couldn't make something that worked as well as they wanted to because it was too powerful for some of it, for its size.
I wouldn't say it's too powerful, but it is definitely like a very strange processing choice. The other thing to remember, of course, is that Final Fantasy IV is a very early Super NES game, often pointed out to be, relatively speaking, not that far afield from a Famicom game. For what it's worth, they did a good job with it, and you'd see...
Looks better than some of the other earlier stuff on the Super Famicom, but it was partly, I think it was some really good art direction on just like the base tiles.
Yeah, like it's making good use of the palette, which again is definitely not the WonderSwan's problem. Like the WonderSwan definitely has a good enough palette. But like in terms of like sprite density, like the Mode 7 I'm sure was pain, but also, you know, x86 programming was definitely not a foreign concept by that point, so there were ways to squeeze things out of the CPU, even though it's not the most robust. And remember also, the Super Nintendo CPU is not robust either. It's quite poor. The things that, like, the special hardware modes are designed to in part get around the fact that the original CPU is kind of bad. There's a lot of things that make this a little more complex. Have you played Ghosts and Goblins on the WonderSwan? Capcom didn't make as many WonderSwan games as Bandai, Banpresto, or Square, but their offerings were remarkable in a weird way. Yeah, it's especially weird because Capcom didn't even make half the games from their own properties, because like Bandai and Banpresto made things like the weird WonderSwan Mega Man Battle Network games. Or like all the fucking Mega Man games on WonderSwan, I think, are Band Presto made, except maybe Battleship Challenge. But yeah, like there's Capcom was remarkably blasé with that platform. They were willing to license and stuff, but they weren't willing to make that much stuff. FF4 was not my most favorite FF, but for some reason it was the one I replayed the most with 9 and 10 2. Didn't have a good time with 1, have a soft spot for 2, but it was pain to replay. 3 is whatever, I don't want to juggle with 5 or 12 job systems if I can. 6, 7, 8, and 10 just put me in a serious mood. I guess there's a reason other than being creators of pets that 4 and DQ5 get so much love in Japan. The other thing is that, like, you can finish FF4 in, like, 12 hours.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember doing it in 15 hours for the original cartridge. I mean, yeah. I'd also say that, I mean, Final Fantasy IV is one of those that you could say was helped define its generation of the genre early on, because it was the first really story-driven Final Fantasy in many ways.
It was also pretty story-driven, but in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, story-driven in a way that actually worked properly.
But yeah, like to finish what point I'm raising with that is also, like, A 12-hour RPG with very little, with a lot of, like, momentum, like, at the end of basically every dungeon, there's going to be some big dramatic swing. It might not be a dramatic swing that means anything, but there will be a big scene at the end of every dungeon. All of that makes it quite memorable, and also means that it's actually pretty likely that people who bought it finished it, and that gives it a lot of cachet in terms of people remembering it.
Yeah. I will say that there are, I mean, you can look at games that came later in the Super Famicom and Game Boy Advance era, mm-hmm. and through the DS, and see a lot of stuff that was held over from Final Fantasy IV in terms of, like, the pacing or some of the environmental styles. I mean, you can see where a lot of people who developed within the next two generations played a lot of Final Fantasy IV. So... just saying.
Yeah. Joe, we've got a quick lull in questions. Tell us what you've been playing, but do it quick.
Okay. Well, real quick, I'd like to contribute to the Metroid Minute, if we can have another minute.
So okay, I will put 60 seconds on the clock.
Okay. I want to just really quick talk about a game called Gestalt, Steam, and Cinder. It is a Metroidvania that you can get on Steam and probably other platforms. And it is a steampunk Metroidvania, and there's some time travel stuff going on, and you get cool gadgets and stuff. So you have a melee weapon. You, as you attack enemies, you build up charge, and you can shoot an electric bullet with your revolver. And I was just playing that real quick, and it was neat. And that's it.
Cool.
So an extra 30 seconds to the Metroid Minute.
The Metroid 90 seconds.
Okay. So then what have I been playing? Let's see. I've been playing Animal Crossing, but I don't need to talk about that. I got Xenoblade Chronicles X Definitive Edition. I bought a Switch 1 cart for $42 and then bought the Switch 2 upgrade. I'm playing in docked mode. I hear it's got some issues in handheld mode, but I think it looks great. It's 60 FPS. So I just started that. When did I get that? I just got it on Saturday. So yeah, I played a few hours of that already. Made a character who kind of looked like Chris Hemsworth, so I named him Thor. Thought that was neat. I got Mario Tennis Fever. I got a fever, and the only prescription is Mario Tennis. Mm-hmm. So that's fun. The story mode is cute. They have you do these neat mini games to build up your stats. So it actually has RPG elements in the story mode, and then you've got a whole bunch of other wacky modes, like you got to hit the ball through rings. You got a mode where a piranha plant may pop up and eat the ball and then grow the court, so then that's more ground you have to cover. And it's wild. There's so many modes, so many characters and rackets. The big thing in the game now is you get a fever shot, so you get different types of rackets, and you can get an ice shot that makes their side of the court slippery. And then you can get a banana racket that creates banana peels that they can slip on, and it's wild. I love it.
Bananas must be stopped.
So there's that. And I got a dock for my Steam Deck and hooked it up to an old TV. So in anticipation of Resident Evil Requiem, I decided, hey, let's give Resident Evil Revelations 2 another shot. And I just cleared the first episode and said, oh yeah, there's things I like and things I don't like, and I'm not looking forward to the parts where Barry has to fight invisible enemies that can one-shot you. But, you know, the Claire and Moira section to start with was quite good, you know, with building atmosphere. And then the Barry section, they give you more weapons and ammo, and there's a lot more enemies, and it's more action-oriented, which is also fine. So you can see how you get two sides of the Resident Evil coin, and that's what Requiem is going to be. As we've seen in the previews, you've got your Leon sections where you're just beating the shit out of zombies, and then you've got the other person, I forget her name, but her sections are meant to be more atmospheric, and there's more ammo scarcity and whatnot. So looking forward to that. I did not receive my copy of East 10 yet, although Paws has assured me it's on the way. They're telling him no later than Thursday for the delivery on that. And we just got hit with a blizzard, so I hope it doesn't get delayed any further, but also glad they didn't try to deliver it like this morning, because that would have been impossible. And yeah, just been playing a lot of old games. I got all the emulators and ROMs set up on Steam Deck now, with the dock hooked up to the TV. So just been playing some old Neo Geo and arcade games and stuff like that, and TurboGrafx 16 games that I've installed on there. I did load up Fire Emblem Path of Radiance on the GameCube emulator and beat the first level. And I have some fond memories of that game, but also I remember constantly restarting stages because somebody died. And I have said before, I absolutely hate when Fire Emblem has permadeath for characters. I always turn that off when the option presents itself.
Permadeath sucks. Permadeath sucks. Well, sucks as it's presented in Fire
Emblem. I mean, in general, yes, yeah. Death is a very inconvenient thing.
Not loving death.
So back to the questions.
Yeah, let's hit some more questions. Okay, to continue my chain of questions about FF7 Remake, for the few people who think Rebirth didn't deviate enough from the original, what do you, a longtime FF7 fan, point out about the flaws and missed opportunities of the original story? I don't like the idea of, like, missed opportunities, because, like, any interesting world has infinite possibility for expansion. And, like, seven, like, you know, well, we'll just continue with this. You talked about how the original didn't talk about other branches of Avalanche and Barrett's group for the Radicals. Any other examples? Like, if we include things that have been expanded, I think that, like, the key ones end up being, like, Shinra's tendency towards, like, getting excited about a project and, like, funneling a bunch of money into it and then giving up on it because they got bored. and the use of Wutai as a scapegoat. Like, Wutai is in the original, and it's, like, been clearly destroyed. Like, the concept that there was some sort of war with them is, like, touched on, but perhaps due to an issue of translation, perhaps just because of the original writing, not a lot gets done with it. Like, and so one of the things that, like, expanded content and 7 Remake and Rebirth do a good job of doing is bringing a lot more to light with that, and making it feel like, okay, they're like the Shinra uses Wutai as a scapegoat of, like, whenever something goes wrong, it's like, well, Wutai did this, so, you know, as a placatory measure. I think those are the ones that it does the best job of expanding on. There's other things that I like, but, like, you'd never have done them in a first go around. Like, they only make sense to do in the context of a remake. Like, I like the expansion on Biggs, Wedge, and Jesse. I think that making them real characters does a lot. I think the scene where you go to the top of the plate, going to the top of the plate actually is another thing. Like, you go to the Sector 4 plate instead of just being, instead of essentially only ever being on a plate to blow up a reactor, like, you actually visit the plate and you kind of see, like, oh, the people with cushy Shinra jobs, this is what their life looks like. Right. And I think that adds a lot to the fiction. But, you know, like some of the other things, like I said, Big Jesse and Wedge, all of them being given a lot more play only makes sense in the context of a remake. In the original, they exist to show that, like, Barrett is not alone, that he has, like, his little, like, cell of people trying to blow up the reactors to save the planet. And the thought to go back and make them a big deal only makes sense when you're playing an entire game where they're around. You know, but in the original game, you're in Midgar for like 4 hours, so there's not enough time in that plot to make them real people. And so that, like, that's one of the nice things you can do with a remake. But yeah.
So were Biggs and Wedge named after the guys in Star Wars?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yes. That's been known for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah. The original translation of FF6 fucks up the same reference and calls them Vix and Wedge, but it's doing the same thing in Japanese.
So the Final Fantasy VI characters were named after those two, and then 7 and 8 and 9 all had characters referencing Final Fantasy VI. And then Final Fantasy IV, the after years, retroactively made two of the officers on Cecil's airship at the start of Final Fantasy IV, Biggs and Wedge.
Okay, and is Barrett the way that a Japanese person might pronounce bullet?
Not exactly, but it's definitely a reference.
Okay.
It's probably meant to be, like, at least draw the mind to that.
Okay. Yeah.
I've already asked about the people who did not play the original game but absorbed FF7 through cultural osmosis. Thus, their perception of Cloud stuck to that of the moody ex-soldier who jumped off the train. That was the audience Advent Children was made for. Let's put those people aside and talk about those who have played the game. Midgar remains one of the strongest opening areas in a Japanese RPG. Its design and vibe certainly the most prominent when it comes to the popular perception of FF7. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things that sticks out because, like, the entire rest of the world is designed to contrast it. Like, There is one other place that is even semi-comparably industrialized, and that's Junon. And but every other place is just like, it is a it's mostly like small towns that, like, another thing that Remake and Rebirth do that's nice, like Rebirth in particular in this case, is that it makes it clearer how Shinra's, like, soft power continues to spread throughout the world. Like, you get, you see when you first go to Calm that, like, oh, all of those places, like, they, you can better understand, like, the flow of Mako throughout the planet. Like, this is electricity to them. You know, it needs to flow everywhere. You get your, like, Calm has, like, a nice, Calm and FF7 Remake in general does a good job of explicating on the gathering concept, like the men in black cloaks. Like, since we get a better idea, we see people who are clearly going to become the men in cloaks, but, like, we see them before that, so we see how, like, the Genova cells and Sephiroth and all of that are causing a lot of people who worked for Shinra in one capacity or another to slowly kind of lose themselves. And I think that gives that entire plot point a lot more verve.
I vaguely remember seeing at least one character who is, in hindsight, obviously suffering from this in the original game.
Yeah.
Somewhere in Midgar where he was having, like, a small psychotic breakdown. Intent. But it wasn't obvious what was going on until you look back much later and realize, oh, yeah, it was that.
Yeah, we, like, Rebirth, one of the nice things it does is that it gives you a few people that are like, oh, this is like I'm seeing this person as an actual person. So, like, it kind of better sells the tragedy of, like, oh, this person's breaking down. Like, they're kind of losing it. I think that gives it a lot more texture. To do that, but in general, like, I've said it before, and I'll just briefly touch on it again. I think that the people overstate the complaints that, like, it didn't change enough, just because, like, there's a lot of interesting explication and expansion in terms of, like, trying to get across those themes. Let's see. Did the subsequent areas live up to it? Fans remember the moments like the Nibelheim incident and Aerith's death, but how much impression did Junon, Wutai, or Temple of the Ancients leave? I think that, like, all of the areas of FF7 have really interesting visual design. There's no place that I would say, like, that's a throwaway area. Junon is, essentially a combination of, like, a port and, like, a pure military base, and they expanded on that a lot. It has my single favorite, like, this is an extremely silly fantasy idea, but I've been ranting about this every so often for months, but one of my favorite things in Rebirth is that a bunch of children in Junon are like, oh, this gas turns you into a toad. It inflicts the toad status effect. We like going around and playing in it. Like, we just play games where we're toads. And that's extremely funny, but it's also very charming because it's like, it's a very good way of bringing across, like, this is normal in this world. Like, your parents will tell you, don't go into the toad gas. And then the kids will go play in the toad gas and then they'll get cured and it's fine. It's whatever. Sometimes people get turned into toads. Like, that's incredibly charming and, like, marries the serious FF7 world to, like, a sense of whimsy that it would be very easy for it to have lost.
Well, when I was a kid, my mom took us swimming at a local place, and we all got pink eye. She brought us to the doctor, and the doctor the doctor was like, did you take them swimming at Hot Brook? And she was like, yeah. Oh, yeah, every kid's getting freaking pink eye from that damn place. So,
some kid shat in the pool. Yeah. But, yeah, like, I think that, like, one of the things that is truly great about FF7 is that, like, I think personally that every area does have a pretty distinct identity, even when, like, many people would say that identity might be slightly inappropriate, like fucking Icicle Honey Inn. Honeybee Inn or Icicle Inn, both of those, like, all these inns. But yeah, like, you know, every, as much as, like, dramatically it seems deranged, everyone remembers the time where Cloud went snowboarding.
Yes.
And then, Corel, like, this completely devastated area where Barret comes from, like, instantly characterizes, okay, this is why Barret is so, so furious. And, like, you know, the version of that in Rebirth gives a bit more, like, texture to his backstory by showing the wife he lost. Definitely makes, adds a lot of addition to, like, his backstory with Dine, which I remember when I first played it in Rebirth, I thought they had made, like, some big changes to that. But, then I went back and, like, looked at the original script, and it's like, no, he always sort of talked like there was something very, very wrong with him. I just didn't fully understand it as a child. But, or Costa del Sol, which is, in the original, you're in Costa del Sol for so little time that it can kind of slip by you that it's not what it is, which is that it's like, we took this town, we essentially drove out all of its, like, normal inhabitants and turned it into a resort for Shinra executives.
It's a resort colony.
Yeah. Like, there existed people here before. We drove them out because we wanted the nice beach. And that implication is in the original, but it's not, like, so little time is required to be spent there that it's easy to walk right past it. And Rebirth, in expanding its time, forces you to sort of be aware of what is happening and why it's like that. But in general, like, I think that's, I genuinely think that there isn't an area that Rebirth didn't do a good job of, like, explicating the thematics that it was meant to have in its original form. Like it does an excellent job of giving all of these places like a more deeply rooted context, because it just has more time and it has more space and it has more like capacity to show you these places. Like in doing that, it manages to give them all that. And that's part of why I'm so excited for Remake Part 3. I want to see like Wutai, like a place that they've done a lot to build up as like, this is a place that is treated as a scapegoat and having its culture obliterated, or Rocket Town, to see like the kind of place where like Shinra did a bunch of investment all at once and then decided they didn't really care. All of those are great. And like, I will say, one of the examples you bring up is the Temple of the Ancients. Temple of the Ancients is great in the original. I honestly, if there was a place I would say I like the original version of better, it would probably be the Temple of the Ancients. Not necessarily the City of the Ancients, but the Temple of the Ancients, because in terms of its design, because it's impossible to fully recreate the surrealism of the original area, which often has places where the art style shifts, or like you kind of end up in a weird Escher situation. Like that was not really recreatable with the art style. They do their damnedest. It's still a great looking place. I kind of prefer the original. Let's see. Speaking of Temple of the Ancients, which dungeon in an FF game is the most memorable? I remember playing FF12 without a guide and missed out on the Zodiac Spear because I opened every chest at the Thousand Beach. Yeah, everyone had that experience. Like, honestly, it's for me, just because of how much I obsessed over the game, it's probably something from FF7. And like maybe up to and including just the Temple of the Ancients itself, because of its surrealism, both because of how it's laid out and because it's when Cloud's brain is starting to break.
Is Cloud doomed to become one of those wanderer things?
Who can say?
Okay.
Well, I mean, if he wasn't successful in fighting it off, but he's kind of like the one exception that manages not to.
Right.
Well, he does go completely crazy, but not in the full way.
Do okay. I have a number? But yeah. Yeah, like for me, it's actually probably the Temple of the Ancients, just because of the surrealism involved. But you know, I could bring up some other good ones. Like I like the weirdness. I tend to like weird ones, so I like Memoria and like Terra in FF9. Like once they start getting weird and abstract, I tend to dig it. I like the concept of Ultimacia's Castle in terms of like slowly unlocking your abilities, but also I can't fully forgive that it absolutely just fucked me as a child, because I wasn't really built up with I had gotten through the game without a good enough understanding of the game to understand how to get through without having GFs unlocked, and that ability is sealed at the start, so rough one.
Time compression.
10-year-old is stupid.
No, that game can make anyone feel stupid.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, like, yeah, it was a rough one.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, I'd bring those up. Like, I have, you know, a lot of these, like, last dungeons, a good last dungeon really sticks with your mind. I like the Lunar Subterrane, just because it, like, it feels so alien after a game that's mostly been normal fantasy, and then the game just goes insane. The final dungeon of FF3 is just bastard hard. And then, let's see, are there any others I would really point to and say, like, that's a dungeon that sticks with me forever? Even in games I love, like FF15, there's not a lot of dungeons where I'd, like, point it and say, like, this is an incredible dungeon that stuck with me. So maybe I'll stop. Anyone got any that they want to bring up?
The final dungeon of Final Fantasy VI is still my favorite.
Oh yeah. It just be like the, for me, this is just like I don't care that much about six, so that didn't stick with me either.
I understand that. Yeah, just getting to use three different parties, exploring that whole thing.
Yeah, like that was a very innovative thing to do at the time. I won't.
Especially the final fight there. I really enjoy where you lose people.
It's overkill if you did most of the. It's overkill if you did most of the World of Ruin, but.
Yeah. Yeah,
that might actually be its biggest problem. Just that, like, if you've played enough of the game to have characters to sub in, if someone dies, no one's gonna fucking die.
I had plenty of people die. I mean, it is easy to overlevel yourself in that game, but I have played it not overleveled, but like gone there pretty early and have either not beaten it or barely scratched by.
Fair enough. I just mean like to take full advantage of like the idea of like, oh, my character died.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Like to the point where like they seemed to be trying to address that with how Bizarro and Safer Sephiroth work in FF7. Where like, how many parties do you fight them with? And how much HP do they have? Well, it depends upon if you have a multitude of like weird factors, which really doesn't do much, but it does make it harder to kill them before they get a turn. Bizarro Sephiroth, like if you're high enough level and if you possess, Safer Sephiroth, if you possess, if you just own the Knights of the Round materia, like he gains like a bazillion HP. If you have all of the characters and they have a high enough average level, the game will force you to split parties for Bizarro Sephiroth, and like Bizarro Sephiroth will have more parts and more HP. Like all of the, like it is interesting to see that because like they kind of wanted to redo that idea. They couldn't do it for the full dungeon, but they wanted to make sure that like it was going to be harder for you to not be able to see the gimmick. But yeah.
I like the post game content in Final Fantasy 13 because you go back to Grand Pulse and they let you just fully explore it, and it's the only really big open area. Most of the game is linear. And no, I like the post game because they give you all these like quests you can do, like you these bounties basically. So you're hunting down different types of monsters, and that's when you encounter like the Tonberry and some other assholes. And that's the point where every character gets access to every role, and you can come up with some really interesting paradigms with people who, you know, you wouldn't think would have that role. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting.
I want to shout out some things that are not Final Fantasy so that we don't get too single-minded on this. But I will say briefly, one that I appreciate from that I think everyone should be familiar with would be, or at least dimly aware of, the dungeon late in Persona 4 where, like, you get Nanako's like heaven dungeon, where it's like the one time that someone with essentially no baggage, no nothing weighing down their mind in terms of anything other than like pure innocent grief, produces a dungeon that just has a very different vibe than any of the other ones to that point, even though it's still using the same like random proc gen patterns. It manages to give a different vibe, even though it's not mechanically different.
I thought we were only talking about Final Fantasy.
I did too, so I was unfolding back.
Okay.
Yeah, no, pop back in with some non-Final Fantasy ones. I think that
that's okay, well,
every
then
single dungeon in Persona 5. I don't even want to pick one.
Yeah,
I was going to mention the cruise ship, and you finally get to beat up that asshole politician who ruined your life in the first place.
They're all excellent, though.
Yeah.
Every
oh, yeah.
dungeon okay, in well, that game.
Especially in Persona 5 Royal. Yeah.
Yeah.
You were saying, Gaijin?
Oh, well, the first one that comes to mind, just, or several come to mind, like the entirety of Beyond the Labyrinth. But, I mean,
oh,
just
God.
For weirdness and just, like, funny fitting a theme.
Yeah.
Metal Saga, Season of Steel. Obviously, it's one of the Metal Max games, so it's got the whole post-apocalyptic thing going on. But yeah. There's this one area that you have to get through in the DS game where it's yeah. a remnant of some sort of high-tech amusement park. Except mm-hmm. as soon as you step inside, it looks like Dragon Quest. it is a modular like holodeck that mm-hmm. You can trigger things to reshuffle the rooms around to try and find a way through, but mm-hmm. it's just, I mean, you can find items in there only that can only be found in there that are direct references to Dragon Quest, and there's even a robotic dragon that you have to destroy at one point. But it's just, it's like, of all the things to put in a game that's mostly full of robots and deranged mutants, and here we have somebody's cute little homage.
Yeah. It's useful to break format sometimes.
Yep. Especially since in order to get there, you have to somehow find a way around a giant, an oversized replica of a World War II Panzer with flamethrowers attached.
Mm-hmm.
So, before you get to the spot.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And why I'm really hoping we hear something about the new Metal Max games eventually, because yeah, I probably. Just want to... I want a nice recent memory associated with a series that is not Xeno.
Fingers crossed.
Yep. Speaking of the antithesis to this question, every single dungeon section of Metal Max Xeno Reborn. Awful. Awful.
Okay. Yeah. I really liked all the dungeons in Beyond Oasis. I played that a lot as a kid. But... then there was that one dungeon where you get cast into like the sewers underneath the castle, and it's like
sewer level.
I hated it. Oh man, it was. And the whole point is you get this cube to give to the villain because he's threatening to kill your little sister. And then you go to the final dungeon of the game, and it's like very different from the rest of the game in terms of the colors and the tone. And then you fight the last boss, which isn't that hard. And then you find out that the villain is actually your older sister who went missing years ago. And I thought it was just a neat story. But yeah, no one likes a sewer dungeon. No.
Okay, I like pick a one sewer dungeon. Dungeon. No, I don't.
No, you don't.
I was saying the words.
Okay, so a quick one, Gaijin might have some insight on. Other than Tokyo, where else in Japan can games take place to be able to have a lot of foreign characters? My brother's family visited Hokkaido last month, and according to him, there were a lot of foreigners working in the hospitality industry, almost as many as Okinawa.
Well, if we look at whichever of the Yakuza games it was that had 5 or 6 characters, 10 characters?
That's 5.
Yeah, okay, so Yakuza 5, if you look at Yakuza 5 or Devil Survivor 2, you can get most of your answers in those two games.
Fukuoka.
Yep. So we got Tokyo, we got Fukuoka, Hiroshima, Sapporo, Osaka.
Basically,
Okinawa.
all the cities you've heard of.
Yeah. Basically, those 5 locations are your best bets. I mean, in general, any large city is probably going to have at least a marginal foreign population nowadays. But those 5 are the ones that are, if anything is going to show up in a game. That where the world map is not specifically organized off of Japan, aka Pokemon, then yeah, it'll be one of those 5.
Gotcha. Fireman continues. Inaba's out in the boonies, but it's still a pleasant enough place to live. Can you make an RPG with social mechanics, but set in places of extreme conditions where stepping outside can kill you? How many Japanese people love visiting Hokkaido but not living in Hokkaido? I visited the China-Russia border and life ain't easy there, and don't get me started on Central Australia. I think you can do that just because, but like it requires a very different thing. Like, you know, Persona is often based around like casual interaction that becomes very that becomes close through like sustained interaction. I think you were doing...
It's also very based around having a strongly structured lifestyle.
Yeah, also true. Whereas, like, you can do interesting, like, social sim in some place that is a harsh environment because of the forced cooperative nature of such a thing. You could actually make some very interesting stories around the idea of...
I remember hearing about a town in Alaska where pretty much the... basically, the entire town moved into what's essentially a giant shopping mall.
Yeah.
Because it was much more convenient just to have the one building, basically an arcology based off of a shopping mall, instead of having individual houses.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Especially in the middle of winter, because this was way up past the 70th parallel, towards the 70th parallel. So... Mm-hmm. And there were no other real communities in the county.
So. Yeah. But yeah, like, I think that, like, the nature of either, you know, a community like that where, like, you have no choice but to be close, or the nature of having to rely on other people just for your daily survival can produce a lot of interesting ideas about, like, a social sim where, like, you know, maybe you either see someone more than you'd want to, or that you see them, that when you see them, it's because something very important is happening. Like, those two things can produce a lot of interesting social elements, but they would produce very different ones.
Sure. Well, I was going to say, State of Decay 2 kind of did that. You know, it's a zombie apocalypse, but you also have to manage your house, and you have to keep characters happy or they'll leave, and so you're all stuck together, and so some characters don't like each other, but they have to stay there. But honestly, that was the worst aspect of the game, though, and it was so frustrating when a good, strong character with good skills is just like, oh, I'm out, I'm not happy anymore. It's like, well, where the hell are you gonna go? Like, there's zombies everywhere. I don't know.
Some people are just like that.
Yeah.
But, okay, to hit another one. I asked last year about the absurdity of being nostalgic for PS1 graphics when developers at the time didn't like the hardware limitations one bit. Many modern games that tried to emulate the PS1 and PS2 look just slap a filter on it and call it a day. You don't try one bit to approximate the techniques old developers created to circumvent the PS1's limitations. In part, like, I'll cut them some slack there. It's because a lot of them probably don't have a lot of access to that information. Like, you might see what they did, but even knowing what they did, like how they did it, might not make any sense on modern hardware, or might actually create problems. So I'll give them that. And like, I will also, like, I probably brought this up last time, so I won't belabor the point, but most fake NES games don't really abide by NES problems or use NES style techniques either.
Well, then we get stuff like Shovel Knight, where it's like, oh yeah, this is like better than NES. You know, they fixed everything that was wrong with NES games.
I wouldn't say fixed everything that was wrong, but it's not working under the same. It is blatantly cheating things like palettes and sprite limitations. Yeah. Let's see. I know that developing games is hard and precarious, and that it's natural for people to take the easy way out. But the idea of lazy nostalgia and surface understanding of the game. The past just irks me. Yes, you can say that the vibe is what most people want, but like, if you're going to analyze art in the context that exists, shouldn't creative process to have something to do with it? I think there's worth in that, but there's also just the fact that like, fundamentally different hardware makes that, like, you end up with techniques that, when imitated directly, don't produce the same results. Just because the hardware context ends up different, or the development environment ends up different, like, it can be hard. So you do kind of end up, like, having to decide what you're willing to sacrifice. And I think, as you know, as we all know, like, the choice is ultimately going to end up being in favor of the... Man, you're getting your ass beat.
Yeah, I'm very tired.
Oh, what's he playing?
That makes sense. He's playing FF7 Remake.
Okay.
But yeah, like, ultimately, because the fundamental hardware and development environment are so different, there's really only so much you can do regardless. Cloud has two ATB bars. You could use those to heal. Because the environments are fundamental, the development environment and hardware are so fundamentally different, trying to directly imitate them won't produce the same results either. So I think that there's some degree of need to just, you kind of have to wing it. You have to try to achieve the same result based on what you have. Like, especially with some of the some things that are hardware issues, like it's hard to recreate the N64's particular brand of anti-aliasing fuzziness, because it's a combination of the fundamentally low resolution of most of the texture work plus the system's hardware-based anti-aliasing, or it's hard to recreate the PS1's unique issues with texture warping, because it's due to the hardware having no floating point texture math. Like, you just end up with these things that, like, and there might be worth in recreating those or try, but like, the fundamental nature, in order to recreate the techniques they used, you would have to recreate the problem and then use the techniques.
Yeah, they use a lot of creative problem solving that we just don't have to do anymore. Right.
Yeah, and I guess that's what he's getting at. Like, the idea that, like, you do, if you want to look authentic, you do have to run into those problems. But, like, even recreating those problems accurately represents its own problems. some of them are very hard to recreate. It's sort of like how, I'll use this as an example. There's always a debate about whether Mega Drive / Genesis sound is being emulated accurately, and that's in part because several of the a lot of the Model 1 Genesises are using broken Yamaha sound chips that Sega had sourced for cheap.
Okay.
So it's nearly impossible to properly recreate those without fucking up something else. And so, like, ultimately a lot of times they'll end up sounding slightly wrong, because, like, then later Genesis models will have Yamaha sound chips that aren't completely broken.
Right. I had the Model 2.
Yeah, and Model 2s just fundamentally sound different than Model 1s because of this.
Right, okay. And I love the sound of it. It's nostalgic in a way, but yeah, when I play emulated Genesis games, they sound fine to me because I had a Model 2. Okay.
Huh. Okay, I will be back in just half a moment.
Okay. Well, I think it's worth mentioning again how impressed I was with UFO 50. And a small indie team came up with 50 distinctly different games that remind me of NES, TurboGrafx, stuff like that. And then they sold it for $25. And as a matter of fact, I think it's getting re-released as a physical edition on Switch.
It is.
So if you haven't picked it up yet and you're a physical collector, I would definitely look into that. I mean, it's like 50 cents per game. I mean, they're not all zingers, but they don't have to be. I mean, Party House and Nightmare alone are worth it.
Okay, let's hit a couple more of these before my voice gives out.
We should probably talk about the PlayStation show.
Oh, I thought you guys did that before I came on.
Yeah, we did not.
Yeah, no, let me look at what all was on there. Like, I'm going to be real. A lot of those games are not for me, so a lot of them immediately slid off my brain.
Well, I want to sing a song real quick. Are you ready?
Oh, no.
Who's that man in the cardboard cube?
Oh, God.
It's just a box. Nobody suspects a thing. Thank you.
Just accept the golf clap.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
We actually have one. It's ready to go.
I did a parody of the theme song from Octodad because of the octopus game where you're... The octopus stealth game. Yeah.
Yeah, that looks weird.
It's called the Darwin effect or something. Yeah. It's basically Metal Gear Octodad. You play as an octopus and you sneak around, and it's Metal Gear Solid, and it looks neat. Yeah.
So I'm looking at the PlayStation blogs list, which doesn't present them in order. They're not in the order they were shown.
It's bizarre. Right.
Yeah, it's in alphabetical order, which I suppose makes a certain degree of sense, but it's just weird. Okay, so yeah, we saw a bunch of stuff that's like, here's another trailer for like 007 First Light that still looks cool.
John Wick game.
Brigandine is back. I don't know why Brigandine is back, but that's coming out on everything.
Is Brigandine any good?
I mean, this isn't the first time it's come back either, is it?
No,
yeah, but it's the first time it's come back in America. Let's see. I absolutely despise the name of the video game For Loop, and whatever it actually was slid off my brain. I think it's some sort of co-op roguelite shooter.
Is it another like live service multiplayer game?
I have no idea.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it's just a co-op shooter, but we shall see. Any multiplayer shooter gives me like you might be a live service game. Who can say?
But no, I think I know which one you're talking about, and I remember watching it, and I'm like, this just looks like generic.
I was right, roguelike co-op shooter. No, I don't care.
No, no, oh god, no! It looked like the most generic ass thing ever.
Yeah, like I'm mostly just annoyed by its cutesy name, which is a programming joke. For you see, it's a for loop, but they spelled it with the number 4.
I hate it.
Yeah. Let's see. Beast of Reincarnation.
This is how I feel about it.
Actually. Oh, sad.
Yeah, Wheels was playing with the Discord soundboard last night. I apologize in advance. Okay, so some quick ones.
What?
God damn this you. I will put you into the ground.
All right, fine.
Okay.
Fine.
You know what?
Stop.
Okay, I'm done. Right,
stop. I will kill you. We got some more of Beast of Reincarnation. That's Game Freak's PS5.
That looks cool. Thing. You get a dog, a pet dog. Yeah.
There is in fact a dog. For me, it's like waiting to see how it proves itself, but interested. Brigandine Abyss. It's if you know what Brigandine is enough to know what this is, you're excited. If you don't, it's a strategy RPG. I think the 2D art is really nice. I think the 3D art looks extremely generic and bad. Let's see. There's a new Castlevania. It's woohoo! From some portion of the Dead Cells development team. There's a big old brouhaha about who is doing what on that. But there is a new one. It's apparently being made by Evil Empire and Motion Twin, and it's called Castlevania Belmont's Curse. It is, of course, coming to everything.
Looks cool.
It looks neat enough. I have a lot of Castlevania-like things. I'm more interested in Bloodstained 2, but I won't turn my nose up at this.
Right. It's not even... It's $40, so it's not even like a full 60 or 70.
Yeah, that's a smart move. That is not a $70 game, but... Yes.
I wish Ubisoft had done that with Prince of Persia. Maybe we would have done better. But that's still a whole different story.
Still sold like a million units.
Yeah, I know. You made one of the best Metroidvanias of all time and sold well, and you weren't happy?
They are never happy.
They did not understand the logical ceiling of how much a Metroidvania game typically sells.
These people just stare at spreadsheets all day and look at bottom line. That's all.
Okay, so we saw a bit more of Control 2. I was not Control 1's biggest fan, but I know that's a big deal game, so glad that's coming out.
At least it's a non-generic game. I don't know if it's for me, but at least it's weird and interesting.
I was more baffled by it because it was like, Control 1 is mostly a shooter as far as I played before I got bored. And this is very much not, but...
Yeah, Control 1 really pulled me in with the story, but then it gives me kind of boring, you know, third-person shooter combat, and I got absolutely stuck at one point, and I just didn't feel like playing anymore.
Mm-hmm. There was something called Crimson Moon. It was another thing that sort of looks like Dark Souls. There's a lot of those. The thing you were pumped about, Darwin's Paradox.
Yes, Darwin's Paradox.
Which has like a weird, like direct lift of Metal Gear Solid in it as well. We got the announcement of a new Dead or Alive as well as Dead or Alive 6 Last Round. No, there is no way to upgrade from original Dead or Alive 6. No, I don't know why they're bringing back Dead or Alive 6. That game's reputation is horrendous. I don't think it was wise. But...
And they alluded to releasing even more characters and costumes for 6, even though it's supposed to be Last Round.
Yeah.
Last Round final. But yeah, like that, like the big deal is Dead or Alive 7, but I'm not convinced they learned the right lessons. So we'll see where that goes. Extraordinarily strangely, one of the first things that was announced was Death Stranding 2 on PC, which is a weird way to start your PlayStation conference. Like, I get that was a PS5 game that is coming to PC. It's still weird to me that they like started with Death Stranding 2 is coming to PC, and it's coming very soon, which is to say, like, next month. So if you don't have a PS5 and you like Death Stranding, that's coming out soon. There's a Ghost of Yotei DLC in March. It's a co-op multiplayer mode. I don't get that, but I'm sure that, you know, like, Ghost of Yotei was popular. I'm sure you'll find plenty of people to play it with.
I hope Sony doesn't start saying everything is a PlayStation, you know.
Give it time. 5 years. We saw the...
They announced they're remaking the God of War trilogy, but they had no footage to show. Oh, you were. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
Let me do this in order. I have opinions. Okay. Let's see. But there's a John Wick game. That feels like it's about 3 years late. I feel like the time to do that was, you know, 2022, when like that franchise is riding high. I feel like it's kind of cooled off since then.
But it looks cool.
I do not remember anything about the trailer other than like photorealistic Keanu Reeves.
But he's so nice.
I do like Keanu. I'm not here to knock Keanu. Let's see. There's a sequel to Kena: Bridge of Spirits. The first one I didn't care for. And
it's boring as shit. I'm going to be much harsher towards it. That game is boring as shit.
Yeah, hopefully the sequel's better, but that's coming out sometime. I think it's this year, but they didn't put a firm date on it. For absolute lunatics like me, they announced a Legacy of Kain Defiance remaster that will also, if you get the deluxe edition, come with a demo of the canceled Legacy of Kain 6. So that's
weird.
I'm excited for that. they give the option. What's that?
One to get the collectors excited.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a psychopath like me, you heard about Legacy of Kain: The Dark Prophecy, a game that was briefly in development for like a year, 20 years ago, and always wanted to see what the fuck they were doing with that. So, you know, that's for me.
I mean, it's going to get some people to, you know, instantly buy it. It does its job.
Yeah, me.
It actually makes them some money, despite being a completely failed project. Yes.
The other thing I will say about that one that's weird is that the original Legacy of Kain Defiance is basically a Devil May Cry knockoff. And for some reason, they have given it a free camera, which is just an extraordinarily strange thing to do. The game is built around a fixed camera angle. I will probably be playing it with the original camera. But just a strange choice. They showed some Marathon. That's coming out on March 5th. I feel like that's probably still being sent to die, but we'll see.
Yeah.
It's actually gotten a lot of positive buzz prior to release. So it's probably going to do it. Just fine.
I hope for Bungie's sake it does.
I will be playing it.
Gross.
I mean, you had to know that was going to happen. Even out of, like,
employing your "this is boring" drop with extraordinary regularity.
Do you even like extraction shooters?
I don't care.
We've never played one.
No, yeah. I don't care. They are resurrecting a long dead Mac franchise. So if there's any story elements to it, I'm going to be interested. So
where's Ganop?
What's that?
Yeah.
Where's Ganop? That was Bungie's first game. It was just Pong. That's why its name is Pong, spelled backwards.
Ganop.
Not.
Yvonne et Niage.
Let's see. They showed a few more characters from Marvel Tokon. I have absolutely no idea how Magic and Danger showed up as base roster characters for a Marvel game, but okay.
Magic is pretty popular right now. Danger has not existed in probably a decade in the comics.
So Danger is just the Danger Room personified somehow? Right?
Yeah. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
When I saw that name on the list, I thought I was reading a typo.
Okay.
But yeah, there are 20 characters in the roster. I probably wouldn't have used one of those slots for Danger, but I suppose you want to have at least one person who's like, what the fuck is this? That's an important part of any healthy fighting game roster.
So I feel like there's like 20 other who the fucks are this that would have been better. There's so many.
You want someone who's more interesting than Danger when someone says who's this.
Yes.
Well, I'm really glad they didn't pick MODOK. Like, ugh.
I would take MODOK
funny, at least
over Danger any day.
Okay.
Okay. So we got another Metal Gear Collection, Master Collection 2. This is a kind of a skimpy collection compared to the previous one, which had Metal Gear 1, Metal Gear 2, Metal Gear 1 NES, Metal Gear 2 Snake's Revenge, Metal Gear Solid, Metal Gear Solid 2, Metal Gear Solid 3. Like that and the digital graphic novels. Like that was a beefy collection.
Right.
This is Metal Gear Solid 4, Metal Gear Solid Peace Walker, and Metal Gear Ghost Babel. Two of those are really are good. But I feel like you could have added a bit more than that. Like, you know, throw in acid, throw in like something. There are weird Metal Gears you could throw in that have not been collected. I don't know. Like, it's nice
they that Metal Gear Solid 4. They could have done Revengeance.
Yeah, throw in Portable. Acid, throw in Revengeance. Something like, or even garbage ones like Portable Ops. Like, throw in the games that, like, you know. Like, that's what you fill out this kind of collection with. You've got your anchor titles. You don't have, like, any, like, this is basically a two-pack and a bonus game. And, like, I'm sure it took a lot of engineering work to get MGS4 running on modern consoles in a way that looked acceptable. I'm glad that it's available. That game kind of sucks.
Yeah, are they still going to keep the long-ass loading screens of Snake smoking?
those are not loading screens. Those are install screens, so those are likely gone.
Right, okay.
Because when MGS4 released, there were three configurations of the PS3. One was 20 gigs, one was 60 gigs, and one was 40 gigs. And two of those could not contain all of the data, so it had to install between acts.
Right.
But yeah, I would suspect that you will not see much of those. Like, even if you have to install the game, which you will on PS5 and Xbox, and, you know, basically will on Switch.
Yeah.
Even if you have to install the game, you're not going to be seeing those screens. You might be able to have open up a bonus feature and watch them.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I got the PS3 at the end of 2007. And I think it was the first model that did not have PS2 backwards compatibility. And if I had to guess, it probably had the 40 gigabyte hard drive. And that's probably
those were
why.
The cheap ones.
Right, I probably got the cheap one. And I remember trying, like, I liked that game, but at the same time, it's like, there were too many cutscenes. There was like 45 minutes of...
That the problem is the cutscenes. I think the problem is that, like, it's probably Kojima's least interesting story.
Yeah, and I just remember, like, those stupid install screens that took forever, and it's like, all right, I guess I should go make a sandwich while he smokes, you know?
Yeah, so it's going to take 5 to 10 minutes. I think like one of the jokes that the game tries to make in Act 4 like has forever like radicalized me against the game. Because there's a bit where you get to the end of we're going to lightning round the rest of this. I will finish this thought. There's a bit where you get to the end of you get to the place where you would have switched discs in Metal Gear Solid 1 because you did in Statue Level and Shadow Moses. And then when you do that, for some ungodly reason, Otacon interrupts you to talk about how you're going to have to switch discs. And then he's like, oh, we don't have to anymore because it's Blu-ray now. And it's like, motherfucker, I would have enjoyed switching discs over having to sit through 5 to 10 minute install screens every 2 hours. But yeah, just a joke that lands on deaf ears. Okay, quick ones. We saw another fucking Mina the Hollower.
Yes.
Trailer that does not have a release date. Hopefully soon.
Spring. That's all.
Something called Neva Prologue. I don't know anything about Neva. PlayStation Blog, why on God's green earth do you have a separate listing for PlayStation Plus? Fuck off. Pragmata is somewhere. Pragmata, that's looking really good. Looking forward to that in April. Project Windless was the thing that was like, oh, it's Chicken Man killing things. And then everyone's like, oh, that looks great. And then it's like, oh, it's being made by Kraft and it's AI slop.
Yeah, I liked the Chicken Man, and then I found out it was AI, and I'm like, I should have known that, because he was funny looking. Only an AI would come up with such a goofy looking Chicken Man. Huh.
You can get humans to make artisanal Chicken Mans. Okay, so there's some more ones. There's the Rayman 30th Anniversary Edition. I picked that up. That game is balls hard, absolutely rude as hell, and that game needs a patch. There's some fucked up. There's some issues where like the new soundtrack will play over top the original soundtrack, and it sounds cacophonous and horrible.
Yikes!
Which is a shame. But otherwise, like, you know, you get access to all of the weird, obscure PC expansion packs. You get the Jaguar version, you get the Game Boy Advance version, you get the PS1 version, and you get the Game Boy Color version, which is just a completely different game. So there's a lot of value in there for your like $20. Okay. I suspect it'll get patched, so I'm not too worried. A Resident Evil Requiem trailer that comes out in a week. Konami announced some sort of RPG called Rev Noir. There was nothing notable about this video game other than that it's an RPG. This was extremely generic
noir.
Noir.
For some reason, I thought it was related. I misread it as Nier instead of Noir, and I thought, oh, another Nier game. No. Nope. Okay.
But yeah, Konami's making an RPG that looks extraordinarily generic. Saros, that's the new one from Housemarque. It looks like it's very much continuing the path they set for themselves with Returnal.
Yeah, I had no interest in it, but it turns out they added some new features to make it easier. So now it's like, yeah, Returnal was way too hard for me. I couldn't get through it. I couldn't beat the first boss in the first biome.
Yeah.
But now I might be interested in Saros because of new, you can lower the difficulty in different ways. Yep.
More lightning round. FFF. Silent Hill Townfall. It looks like an actual video game now. Could be interesting. Star Wars Galactic Racer. I didn't care about this, and then I found out that it was being made by a bunch of people who used to work on Burnout, and now I care.
Yay. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I did not know that. That's amazing news.
Yeah, yeah. It's a studio composed of, like, ex-Criterion people, so awesome. I actually care now.
Nice.
Something called Yako Shinobi Ops. If you told me that was real, I would say, like, I don't remember a single thing about this.
No.
Okay. And then the last thing on here was God of War Trilogy Remake. I feel like I am losing my goddamn mind. You just closed Blue Point. Why are they not the ones making this?
Baffling.
Why'd they close Blue Point? What did they do wrong? They were cool.
Blue Point did not have a project in development since their God of War Live Service game was canceled. I would suspect this has much to do with Sony's, like, allegedly they pitched at least four games, so I would imagine that this has much to do with Sony's internal politicking. But, like, I would describe it as gross mismanagement if you can't find a project for one of the most talented remaster teams in the business.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
You have like a million back catalog games, and you have an incredibly talented studio that's great.
They did the Demon's Souls remake, right?
They did Demon's Souls remake. They did Shadow of the Colossus remake.
They couldn't do Bloodborne PC port finally. No,
there is a very good chance that From Software is the one that is holding up more Bloodborne.
Right.
It is also worth noting that there are, like, I was listening to the Digital Foundry podcast where they were talking about the same thing, and they were mentioning that they had heard that From Software did not like that Demon's Souls remake.
Doesn't surprise me.
But, well, yeah, it was pretty looking, but it was still the same broken ass game.
I don't think that's why they didn't like it. They didn't like it because of the artistic liberties it took. that would be my suspicion. But broadly speaking, like, Blue Point is an extraordinarily technically talented studio. I'm baffled that they were not the ones making a God of War remake. A remake of 1, 2, and 3, like, I'll do a quick, like, little mini rant. God of War can be cleanly divided into its Greek era, aka before divorced angry, and its Norse era, divorced bitter. The only thing that is interesting about the narratives of the Greek games to me is that they are clearly made by people whose, like, families and lives are falling apart, and it is seeping into the games in some of the ugliest ways imaginable. but as far as, like, narratives, this is, like, these are, you know, canceled after one season streaming shows. Like, Sony's desperate reverence for God of War is truly surreal. But I appreciate, like, previously the voice of Kratos, T.C. Carson, had been essentially dropped without even telling him, so it's nice that he at least gets to come back and get a nice paycheck.
Yeah, and I mistakenly thought he was the voice of Three Dog from Fallout 3.
Yeah, no. Completely unrelated dude.
We didn't bring up... during Metroid Minute, we could have talked about the Shadow Dropped God of War prequel. I'm not really that interested in it. I'm like, another? Didn't you already do like three fucking prequel games? Like, I don't I don't care about Kratos as a angry teenager with the spear.
I have to hop off soon, so let's save that for maybe next week, because I am probably going to buy it just for out of curiosity.
Okay.
And also it is co-op, so I may drag my son into playing it with me.
Okay. Time for the plugs?
Yes.
Yeah. Plug.
Plug.
Okay, I'll plug quick. So last week I didn't do my usual RP Gamer streams because the previous week I beat Rune Factory Guardians of Ozima, and then I decided to do a post-game bonus stream and could not actually figure out how to access any post-game content. And then I figured out that you have to get married and have a kid to unlock the post-game, which is odd, but after ending the stream, I had to look it up, and because I had proposed to Ulalaka, she said yes, and then nothing happened. And I'm like, what the fuck? And I had to end the stream. Well, then I went online and found out, no, you have to sleep, and then the next morning it goes into the wedding. And I'm like, oh. Mm-hmm. So
get married the very same day. That'd be silly.
No, but it's just weird because you propose, she says yes, and then it just pretends like it didn't happen. And then, yeah, it was weird. But I found out there's some post-game dungeons if you get married and have a kid. And so there's still some... plenty of farming and social simulator type stuff to do. Now, you can have multiple girlfriends. You can only have one wife. So once you marry one of them, the other relationships automatically end and they don't even get upset. So I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. The end.
Yes, we will be able to watch you stream Proud Nordics in the coming week, I assume.
Yes. So yeah, I decided to just take the week off because just had stuff going on, and also I didn't have a game to play. And yeah, East End Proud Nordic, supposed to arrive by Thursday at the latest. So if it doesn't come tomorrow, I said one way or the other, I will stream an RPG. I don't know which one. I might just do Xenoblade Chronicles X. I don't know, but there will be a stream Tuesday night, one way or the other. And then East 10 starting Thursday. And beyond that, yeah, that's Tuesday and Thursday nights on the RP Gamer Twitch channel is when I do my streams, usually starting around 9 or 10 p.m. And I haven't streamed on my own Twitch channel, but that's twitch.tv/smokeandjoegamer. And over on YouTube, you can look me up under Smoke and Joe Gamer as well. I haven't done any new YouTube videos in a while, but I do have the pre-order on Resident Evil Requiem, so maybe I'll do a video on that at some point. So yeah, so just check that out for additional content whenever I feel like putting something up there. And then, of course, you can follow me on Blue Sky under Joey at smokeandjoegamer.bsky.social. And you can chat with me on Discord. You can join the RP Gamer Discord if you want, and I'm active on there. And we've been talking about Pokemon a lot. As a matter of fact, I'm just remembering I have to... there's a deadline to do a Pokemon feature. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about... It's like 150 words, talk about your favorite game or favorite Pokemon or split it. And I think I'm going to do Pokemon Scarlet and Houndoom.
I think you have to pick game or Pokemon, not both, I think.
I mean, if you can fit it within the word limit, then go ahead. Basically, it's everything.
Or maybe I'll just talk about Pokemon Scarlet, and then at the end just say, by the way, my favorite Pokemon is Houndoom.
Perfect.
And I think that's my favorite. There's too many. There's like 900 of them now.
There's 1,000.
It's closer to 1,100 at this point.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, so... I don't know. I picked one.
Whatever. We got to get the show on the road. Wheels has to go soon.
Okay.
Go.
As seen on Q&A Quest, or heard, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, Kindle and Kindle Unlimited, 13 episodes, 5 side stories, 1 really ridiculously long paralogue, soon to be 15 episodes because I'm still... in the middle of writing the last parts. Yay. Working on that. Okay, and then moving on, we have Vainglorious Long as the Night, a lit RPG, vaguely Metroidvania and B-movie themed. Just me having fun. All of this under the name Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. Also, Tanuki is a Teapot, Japanese folktales all about animals. Cute, sometimes informative, sometimes really obscure. Illustrations by yours truly, because nobody said I couldn't. Okay. And then under the other pen name, Michael Spearwater, is why not? All the stuff that I really do not want associated with a pen name that does young adult fantasy. First of all, we have A Wager for Wanderlust, which is romanticy and travelogue, and me just practicing various themes in narrative format. I don't really think it will sell very well, but you know what? Hope springs eternal. And also new, yay, opening up pre-orders for a different book called The Sin of Tantalus, which is attempt at doing something new and interesting with zombie themes. Note that I really dislike contagion horror and zombies, so I was really mad at my brain for coming up with this idea in the first place several years ago. And I tried to make it work, and I think it's turned out pretty well. So yes, all of that under Michael Spearwater, Spearwater. It is theoretically a real surname. It's just incredibly rare, so you should not have any problem finding it on Amazon, which is the entire point of having the pen name. Okay, so thank you. Okay.
Okay. So real quick, you can ask us questions like dear friend Fireminer did by going to twitch.tv/rpgamer or twitch.tv/askwheels at typically around 8:30 p.m. Pacific, 11:30 p.m. Eastern on Mondays, but sometimes we go a little earlier, depending upon if we have other things to do. You can also see our sister show, Shenanigans, by going to twitch.tv/askwheels at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays. If you also want to ask us questions through less direct means, you can also ask us questions by joining the RP Gamer Discord and going to the podcast section, which you can get to by going to the community tab on RP Gamer. You can also ask us questions underneath this very episode in the comments section on RP Gamer. Normally I would go into more detail, but we don't have time. I need to pop out, so see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
See you. This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.
So sad. So no. Okay. No, this is all we have to use.
You know what? He just left.
He just left.